Teresa Wersbianska for Pacifica Radio.
Good afternoon. This is the Shai Rana Show with your host Zain Al-Amin. This is a show that focuses on Arab culture and politics, and it airs every Wednesday for 1 hour at WPFWFM.org and WBAI-FM.
My name is Nida, and I'm a member of the Palestinian Youth Movement. The PYM is proud to be joining hundreds of organizations from around the world in participating in the March to Gaza, taking place in Egypt, June 12th through the 20th. Thousands of people from around the world will gather together to march through Al-Arish and reach the Rafah border with Gaza to demand an immediate end to the genocide on our people and the immediate administration of aid that the people of Gaza are in desperate need of right now. The situation in Gaza has been catastrophic, and it has been catastrophic for 18 months. The time to act is now. We call on the masses of the world to join us in action. We'll see you in Egypt.
Good afternoon. This is Zain Al-Amin with the Shai Rana Show. That was a global appeal by Palestinian activists to march on Gaza, as mentioned, and this will be happening later in June. And it's going to be a march that approaches Gaza from the border that it shares with Egypt. And it's because obviously there's a vacuum in terms of any kind of action beyond the demonstrations that are worldwide to stop the starvation of the Gazans right now. As you probably have been seeing, there's several reports. There's hundreds of Palestinians that are being hunted down in what's really become a killing cage for people seeking assistance, meaning food. So what they did is the United States government and Israel joined hands and putting up this front that they're going to give aid, and they hired some shady organizations to provide that aid. And as Norman Finkelstein had predicted several weeks ago, when the Palestinians came in and rushed, the Israelis used any kind of disturbance within the crowd to massacre people. And that's the intent, really, of this aid, drawing people south so that they can push them out even more south, and also continuing the genocide that has been ongoing for 20 months now. This appeal goes hand in hand with another topic we'll be addressing today, is the flotilla that is going to Gaza, the aid that is going to Gaza with several actors and celebrities from around the world, and that has already been subjected to drone fire when they were near Malta, and now they're continuing. They're being followed by drones. Last night they were reporting from the flotilla about these drones that are following them, they're at any time they could basically bomb the flotilla. The idea is to break the siege, of course, on food and such in Gaza, and medical aid, of course. And the idea is to take the boat, the flotilla, as far as it can go and bring attention to the fact that nations around the world can also help break the siege if they really meant to. And I say this because there's been several reports about how the tide is turning, and it is. But We've only seen rhetoric right now beyond the fact that, for example, some regions of Italy have cut off aid, or rather relations, economic relations with Israel. And we know that Spain has done so too. We know that we're hearing a lot from the British Parliament, but no real action yet. But so the only way to break the siege is to physically break it en masse. And those attempts right now, approaching from Egypt and approaching from the Mediterranean, are two of those attempts. These are very unlikely to break through the siege, obviously, but they can be the bring attention that there is a way to break the siege if more nations, more individuals, more groups hop on board, and more people of the world, which who are especially in the global south, for breaking that siege, for defending the Palestinians against the Israeli occupation. And with that, I wanted to share our next clip, which is by one of my favorite commentators on the topic of Palestine, and that's Caitlin Johnston. And she talks about here several things. One is the fact that our politicians and European politicians have been actually sending death threats to Greta Thunberg, because she's on the boat on this flotilla to break the siege. And she talks about a very important thing, which is the fact that the resilience of people around the world that have been resisting American and Israeli colonialism and white supremacy have stood their ground and have surprised basically the enemy with their resilience, with what we call in Arabic sumud. So let's listen to Caitlin Johnston and on the threats to Greta and the resilience of our movement.
Israel's backers are now advocating the assassination of Greta Thunberg, notes from the edge of the narrative matrix. U.S. Senator Lindsey Graham has just tweeted an article titled, "Greta Thunberg Sets Sail with Gaza Flotilla That Aims to Break Israeli Naval Blockade," adding the comment, "Hope Greta and her friends can swim." Australian Zionist think tanker Arsen Atrovsky somehow outdid Graham, tweeting, "Oh, look, the little jihadi Greta Thunberg is trying to get into Gaza to show solidarity with Hamas. It would be so sad if something were to happen to her flotilla." There is not a lot that can shock me about Israel and its supporters these days. But if you'd traveled back in time a few years ago, it would have been hard to explain to someone how we got to a timeline that includes Israel supporters openly advocating the assassination of Greta Thunberg. The reason Gaza ceasefire negotiations have kept falling through under both the Biden and Trump administrations is that Israel, with the backing of the U.S. government, keeps insisting on the right to resume its genocidal slaughter after a temporary intermission. A big part of the problem is that this is a genocide, not a war. But all the framing is around negotiating a ceasefire to end the war, even as Israel keeps rejecting any ceasefire agreements which would require them to end the genocide. Hamas insists on an end to the genocide, and Israel goes, "No can do, but tell you what, we can pause the war for a few weeks." And then the mass media go, "Hamas rejects ceasefire," while liberals go, "Oh, it's so sad that they can't negotiate an end to this terrible war." But it's not a war. It's a genocide. You can negotiate an end to a war, but you can't negotiate an end to a genocide. Israel has openly declared that the killing will continue until there are no more Palestinians left in Gaza, either by death or by ethnic cleansing. Israel wants to eliminate all Palestinians from Gaza more than it wants the remaining hostages. It wants to eliminate all Palestinians from Gaza more than it wants peace. Hamas has nothing to offer Israel that it wants more than it wants to purge Palestinians from a Palestinian territory. If this were being treated as a genocide, all law-abiding states would interfere to force Israel to stop. But because it's being falsely treated as a war, they just stand passively by and periodically cluck about ceasefire negotiations, thereby allowing Israel to continue its genocide. The big controversy this weekend was the emergence of a sex tape featuring journalist Glenn Greenwald, which he says was released, quote, without my knowledge or consent, and that the motive was, quote, a maliciously political one. After Greenwald's public statement on the matter, Twitter was flooded with commentators and members of the public from all across the political spectrum expressing their support for him, apparently nullifying whatever effect the release of the sex tape was supposed to have. I'm going to call this a solid win for humanity. The U.S. is removing Syria from its longtime designation as a state sponsor of terrorism now that it has a puppet regime in Damascus, with U.S. envoy Thomas Barak proclaiming that, quote, thank God the issue of state sponsor of terrorism is gone with the Assad regime being finished. This is the U.S. admitting that the terrorist designation just means not aligned with U.S. interests. Syria's new president was an actual ISIS and Al-Qaeda official, literally the leader of Al-Qaeda in Syria. But because he's U.S. aligned, terrorism is no longer a concern. Our rulers did not expect this. They did not expect the public to sustain ferocious opposition to the Gaza Holocaust for 20 months. In October 2023, they would have been assuring each other that all the protesting and outrage would die off soon, because that's what normally happens. And it just didn't. People refused to let this thing fade into the background. The mass media were forced to keep reporting on it, albeit with extreme bias, because if they didn't report on it at all, they'd lose their last shred of credibility in the eyes of the public, and people would keep sharing the information on their own anyway. Remember how excited the Israel apologists got when those two embassy staff members were killed? They were like, well, that's it for the pro-Palestine movement. Saying free Palestine is not allowed anymore, everybody. Ah, thank goodness, I was worried people would never let this thing go. And it just didn't pan out that way. Nobody bought it. The embassy staff killings were shuffled off in the daily news churn and forgotten, while Gaza remained. And I just think it's worth flagging what a miracle that is. How completely unexpected and unanticipated this would have been for our ruling institutions. They really thought we were all sufficiently ground down and subdued by life under the empire to just let them do what they want to Gaza without any resistance. And they were wrong. There's some life left in us yet. It is not a foregone conclusion that we will just passively watch our rulers carry us off over the ledge of dystopia, ecological disaster, and nuclear Armageddon. Revolution is not an impossible pipe dream. There is still a spark of hope.
That was Caitlin Johnson's report on, obviously read by Tom Foley, but it was her report on threats that are being made by Lindsey Graham and European. I mean, these are politicians that are making death threats to the most popular environmentalist in the world. And so you could see the degree of depravity. But what's amazing is this, that there is no, nothing is being done in addressing this issue, that they are making these kinds of threats openly and publicly, and there's no consequence to that. That's the world we're living in. That's what happens when we, you know, when we said that Gaza's the litmus test for global justice. This is what we meant. If you Since the world governments have allowed this to happen, they're going to turn on their own people and use it. And we're seeing this in Sudan right now, where UN units that are coming, aid units that are coming to aid the Sudanese are being attacked openly, because all the international human rights organizations have been dismissed, and therefore we don't have any more basically anybody to that can enforce international law anymore. It's all up to us, as we just heard. The last bit we're gonna listen to is a longer bit by and Electronic Intifada, and by one of my favorite journalists, Jeremy Scahill. If you really want to know what's going on, especially the fact that Jeremy has had access to Palestinians and has had access to the resistance in Palestine, direct access and personal access, and has been attacked for it. He's one of the few independent Western reporters that is able to give you a real picture about what's going on. And in this segment, he's being interviewed by Nora Barros and Ali Abu Nima and Electronic Intifada about what are these real, we're hearing some things about negotiations on the Gaza ceasefire, and we keep hearing that it's Hamas that's turning it down. Here, Jeremy Scahill gives us a sobering assessment of what's going on with the ceasefire. So let's listen to what are Trump's real Gaza ceasefire terms.
To the Electronic Intifada live stream. I'm Ali Abu Nima here with my colleague Nora Barros Friedman. On Wednesday, US President Donald Trump and his Middle East envoy Steve Witkoff expressed optimism for an agreement to bring about a ceasefire in Gaza. We're joined now to talk about the negotiations by veteran investigative journalist Jeremy Scahill. Jeremy has reported from war and conflict zones around the world, including Iraq, Afghanistan, Yemen, Somalia, and Yugoslavia. He is the author of the international best-selling books Blackwater, The Rise of the World's Most Powerful Mercenary Army, and Dirty Wars, The World is a Battlefield. Most recently, he co-founded Dropsite News, where he's been closely following the developments around the effort to negotiate an end to Israel's genocide in Gaza. Welcome, Jeremy.
Thank you, Ali and Nora. And I want to say before we get into the nitty gritty of all of this, that it's really a deep honor to be on this program. I've watched it consistently throughout this genocide, and I've for 20 plus years I've been a fan and a consumer of Electronic Intifada. And I want to also give credit to Electronic Intifada for publishing Palestinian journalists, no matter what is happening. You stand in a class of your own as a platform in the English language for Palestinian journalists to report on their lives, on their struggle, in their own voice. And so I just want to express deep, deep gratitude to everyone at Electronic Intifada for all of the tremendous work you've done, not just over the past 19 months, but over so many years.
Thank you so much, Jeremy. Those words really mean a lot to me and to all my colleagues, I'm sure, especially coming from you. And we're really, really happy to have you with us today because you've been doing some really incredible reporting that no one else has been doing around these negotiations. Before we get into that, let's start by listening to the comments of President Trump and Steve Witkoff about the ceasefire negotiations made during their press conference in the White House yesterday. Let's take a look at that.
You've called for an end to the Gaza war. Given the growing humanitarian crisis and the decision of Prime Minister Netanyahu to extend the military operation, Do you have any frustration with his handling of the situation of the war?
No, we're dealing with the whole situation in Gaza. We're getting food to the people of Gaza. It's been a very nasty situation, very nasty fight. October 7th was a very nasty day, the worst that I think I've ever seen. It was a horrible day, and people aren't going to forget that either. So we'll see how that all works out. And Steve, would you want to say a couple of words about Gaza, because you just have some information? Steve Witkoff, do you want to come up for a second? You might give him a little bit of information as to what's happening with Gaza and also Israel. We're having some very good talks with Iran. We'll find out whether that means anything, but we're having good talks.
Congratulations. Well, hi, everybody. I think we are on the precipice of sending out a new term sheet that hopefully will be delivered later on today. The president is going to review it, and I have some very good feelings about getting to a long-term resolution, temporary ceasefire, and a long-term resolution, a peaceful resolution of that conflict.
Jeremy, we'll get into some of the background that led up to this moment. But before that, you have actually obtained at Dropsite News the so-called term sheet that Steve Witkoff mentioned, the outlines of this new proposal, and you have a new piece that's just gone up about it. Outline for us what you've learned and what the latest developments are.
Well, you know, some of the terms in this are very similar to what existed in the January ceasefire agreement that, you know, Trump basically pushed through just prior to his inauguration. Among them would be that there would be a resumption of aid delivery into Gaza that would be largely coordinated by the United Nations and the Red Crescent, which is interesting because it doesn't say anything about what would happen to the so-called Gaza Humanitarian Foundation, this sham operation that is intended to be part of Netanyahu's war of annihilation against Palestinians and against Gaza as a Palestinian territory. But it also has, you know, typical captive exchange. There's some differences to what Hamas had initially thought was going to be in this. Under this term sheet, it says that 5 living Israeli captives would be released on the first day of a 60-day temporary truce. 5 additional living Israelis would be released on day 7. There would be a total of 18 bodies of deceased Israeli captives that would be exchanged. And the Palestinian resistance would secure freedom for well over 1,000 Palestinians as part of this. Most of them are people that were kidnapped from Gaza explicitly to be used as bargaining chips in exchange deals with Hamas and the Palestinian resistance. I understand that there would be 125 Palestinian political prisoners who are serving very long sentences or life sentences. But where the sort of devil in the detail emerges is that there is language in this so-called term sheet that clearly was crafted to appease Netanyahu and Israel. Hamas had been led to believe that there was going to be a much firmer commitment by President Trump to ensure that there was an understandable, clear pathway to a permanent end to the genocide and a full withdrawal of Israeli forces. In this term sheet, it's language that the Israelis have been pushing throughout the ceasefire process over the past 19 months, and it doesn't lock in anything. It basically just has language in it that says that the mediators, Qatar, Egypt, and the United States, are going to make good faith efforts to ensure that negotiations are serious toward a permanent end to the war. But there's no mechanism for enforcement, and Israel, of course, has a PhD in violating ceasefires. They're continuing to terror bomb Gaza every single day, despite the fact that there was a U.S. guaranteed ceasefire that took effect in January. It also doesn't say anything about how many aid trucks are going to be allowed into Gaza. You know, the fact that they call it a term sheet, which is a business term, indicates that it's not actually a robust or serious detailed proposal. This is the Trump administration's attempt to kind of exploit the vagueness in an effort, really, and Israel and the Hebrew press is saying this openly. They're saying they're trying to trick Hamas into believing that Hamas has gotten what they said would be a red line if they didn't get it, which is a clear path to an end of the war full withdrawal of all Israeli occupation forces. This leaves things very, very vague. So what I think happened here is that, and we could talk about the backstory of it, is that Hamas was led to believe by U.S. envoys that the Trump administration understood that Hamas is flexible on a number of issues, how many captives are released, when they would be released. But the bottom line is Palestine is not going to be disarmed, and Hamas is not going to surrender on its behalf or on behalf of the Palestinian people, and that it must include a pathway that is clearly defined to a permanent end of the war and full withdrawal of Israeli occupation forces. This term sheet does not include that. So I just got off talking with a very prominent Palestinian resistance figure involved with the negotiations, who said that while Netanyahu has front-run the process and said Israel accepts this, that the Palestinian resistance groups, everyone just says Hamas, but there are multiple factions that are consulted in this process. And, you know, they try to represent the fabric of Palestinian politics and consult with people, even those that are not necessarily involved with armed resistance as a, you know, that doesn't have a force on the ground in Gaza. And they're saying that there are so many loopholes in this that from their perspective, they made great concessions in the interest of trying to stop the forced starvation of the people of Gaza. And that what ended up happening again is that the United States assured them, yes, we have this framework. We're going to put pressure on Netanyahu. Give us some time. Lo and behold, Netanyahu comes forward, says we're going to accept this. And I guarantee you what we're going to hear next is the United States and Israel saying Hamas is obstructionist. Hamas doesn't want a ceasefire deal. Hamas, their official position on this, and I think it doesn't get mentioned enough. Hamas has said, we will release every single living and dead Israeli captive on day one of a deal that ensures that Israel is going to cease its occupation, the genocide stops, and the forced starvation of our people ends. That's the deal that Hamas has put on the table for 5 to 7 years. And they've also said that they would make robust commitments that there would be no armed action against Israel unless Israel attacks Palestinians again in Gaza. Those are serious commitments that the resistance movement is making. They haven't gotten serious treatment in the media. Trump's people understand that's the position, and they went ahead and they once again catered to Netanyahu's agenda. It's Biden 2.0 in the micro situation right now. At the end of the day, Donald Trump's a businessman. He has family business interests in the Gulf. He wasn't just on that tour recently to pick up a $400 million airplane and make business deals, quote unquote, for America. His family businesses are at play here. The only thing that ends this genocide, I believe, is if Donald Trump decides that Netanyahu is bad for Trump's personal business. Hmm.
Jeremy, I want to talk a little bit more about this and you know, the pattern that we've seen from the Biden administration and now through the Trump administration. And I want to push back a little bit on you know, the Trump administration kind of posturing itself as catering to Netanyahu when as we know, like, you know, Trump could at any moment pick up the phone and tell him to stop and it would stop. But the pattern dating back to the Biden administration of officials hinting and media reporting that a deal is imminent and then all of that suddenly melting away. And as you said, Hamas getting the blame. Hopes were raised a couple weeks ago because the Trump administration was negotiating directly with Hamas, you know, bypassing Israel. And Hamas agreed to release the U.S.-Israeli dual national prisoner of war, Eitan Alexander. It was anticipated that this would result in the U.S. pressuring Israel to end the starvation siege on Gaza. A lot of people in Gaza were extremely hopeful that a ceasefire was imminent. Of course, that did not happen. There were also expectations, you know, that another ceasefire could be announced. Was that all a trick and a deception? Are there any real disagreements between the U.S. and Israel over Gaza? And also, like, a part of this that we don't, sorry, this is like 10 questions in one, but a part of this that we don't talk about is also an enforcement mechanism. You know, every single time over the last 80 years of Israel's existence in Palestine, there are no, you know, treaties or truces that Israel hasn't completely trampled. What what would an enforcement mechanism look like to make sure that Israel abides by a ceasefire if and when it happens, and that it you know, stops massacring Palestinians, not just in Gaza, but in the West Bank as well?
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot to unpack there. I mean, we can start at the beginning with Idan Alexander, and I know you've covered this extensively on this program, but it's almost unmentioned in any meaningful way in the broader corporate media in the world. Idan Alexander is an American citizen from New Jersey who volunteered to sign up and enlist in the Israeli army. And when he was taken by Palestinian fighters on October 7th, 2023, he was taken in a military uniform from a military base that has been one of the major enforcement mechanisms for the attacks and the slow genocide against the Palestinians of Gaza. And that's why Hamas has said from the beginning that he was a prisoner of war. He's not a hostage. He's not a captive. He's a POW. And really, Hamas and Islamic Jihad viewed Idan Alexander as perhaps their most valuable asset to try to stop the genocide. So I just want to emphasize how big of a deal it was that the resistance agreed to release him. And I, you know, in talking to officials from Hamas and Islamic Jihad, the calculus on their part was that they tried to read the room realistically, which is that Joe Biden was a total nightmare, that he was a committed Zionist. And that Biden was continuing to support the war because he supported the war against Palestinians. His 50-plus year career in American politics indicates that Joe Biden was a bloodthirsty supporter of the most vicious aspects of the Israeli project. In Donald Trump, one Palestinian official from Hamas said it's sort of like dealing with the stock market, where you know you have to kind of watch where the money's moving. In the morning, it might be moving one way, in the afternoon another, and then at the end of the day, you have to scramble to see if you can stop losses or maximize gains. So I think that they took a gamble, and they didn't get a single Palestinian freed from prison for handing over Idan Alexander. That's a couple hundred potentially Palestinians that would have been freed, and Hamas has been criticized for making this deal. But I think from their perspective, they felt that it was the only option they had to essentially jumpstart that process again. And they called it a goodwill gesture to Trump. And what they were promised directly by Steve Witkoff was that on the second day after Idan Alexander was released, that the Trump administration was going to compel Israel to lift its siege blockade and that aid was going to immediately resume. And they also, and they were less confident that this was going to happen, but they were told that before or when Trump visited the Gulf, that he was going to make a public call for an immediate ceasefire and for robust negotiations to begin on a long-term ceasefire. They said the Americans didn't violate the agreement. They threw it in the trash. But I will say this. I don't think that there would be these discussions right now on a new potential ceasefire, even if the one on the table is a terrible deal, had Hamas not made that deal. I think it did pump oxygen back into the process. In terms of Trump, his administration is stacked with Zionists. One of his premier bankrollers, Miriam Adelson, doesn't believe there's a such thing as a Palestinian. Mike Huckabee also has said there's no such thing as a Palestinian. There's no such thing as the West Bank. There is a different wing of Trump world that is not as bloodthirsty or as pro-Israel, but they are in the minority. So I think we have to be very clear-eyed about the fact that this is also a militant Zionist administration that is in power. But the wild card is that Trump is a wants business. And my understanding is that Qatar in particular has been putting a tremendous amount of pressure on Trump and linking it directly to the business deals and saying, listen, we did these things. It's not I'm not saying it was a quid pro quo, but they're saying, look, you've declared a new golden era in the Gulf. We're down with that. This thing needs to wrap up. And I think that there was a belief in Doha and elsewhere that Trump was in fact going to push this thing through. That didn't happen. Clearly, they've once again set Hamas up as to be portrayed as the obstructionists in the room. And I agree with your point. I mean, it was subtle how you made it, Nora, but I do agree with it. I don't think that Netanyahu necessarily is steering the ship, and Trump is caving into him. My guess would be that it's more likely that there are figures within Trump's camp, including powerful figures in the Republican Party that are in the Senate and elsewhere who are putting enormous pressure on Trump to make sure that this deal leaves a very clear gaping loophole for Netanyahu to resume the genocide after day 60 of this temporary deal. You know, the only reason that I draw a distinction between Trump and Biden is that I don't view Trump as an ideological person in the way that I do Biden. I think Biden's whole career says that he was ideologically committed to a war of annihilation against the Palestinians and would often defend Israel when it was at its most violent, and then became the chief facilitator of the most heinous Holocaust inflicted on the Palestinian people since the state of Israel was created. In Trump, I think Hamas saw possibility, not optimism, but possibility. And they had to make moves that they felt were responsible. And, you know, I think there's legitimate criticisms. I've heard it from a lot of Palestinians. I agree with you know, with some of it. But I think that, you know, the other thing to remember is that the negotiators who are in the room dealing with whether it's the Americans or the Qataris or the Egyptians, all of these guys who are falsely portrayed as living in the Four Seasons Hotel and sort of living high on the hog, they've lost family members. You know, Bassem Naim, who's one of the most prominent English language, you know, spokespeople for Hamas, who's on their political bureau and was a former, he's a medical doctor, but he was a former government minister in the Hamas government. You know, his mother was killed. His sister was killed. His nieces and nephews have been killed. His family is still in Gaza. Every single official that you meet with from Hamas that is engaged in these negotiations is watching as their family members, one by one or in groups, are being mass murdered. And that's not the case for Netanyahu or any of the officials that are in the room doing these negotiations. So, you know, I think at the end of the day, you know, Hamas is in a difficult position right now. There's a lot of internal pressure coming within Gaza itself. People are desperate. And I think that the framing of it always leaves out the most essential part. This was part of the plan. Part of the plan was to dehumanize Palestinians to such an extreme, to cause them to exist in famine-like conditions where human nature, especially if you have small children, necessitates that you do anything you can to save your children's lives. So when I see images of Palestinians grabbing food off of trucks or descending on warehouses on rumors that there's flour, the first thing that comes to my mind is this is what Israel wanted. This is by design. So, you know, if Trump wanted this to end, he could end it in an instant. He could end it in an instant. And, you know, I don't know that it's that he's just committed to the war of annihilation as an ideological individual, or it's that he sort of says, well, this is a good enough deal. But I'll tell you this much. I don't think that the resistance is going to capitulate to these terms. You know, in a way, it all just boils down to whether Trump decides it's bad for business. And it's sick. It's really sick that that's the reality, but I think it's true.
Hmm. Yeah. You've kind of answered my next question, which was really going to be about the Gaza, so-called Gaza Humanitarian Foundation. And Nora talked about that in the newscast. They opened the first of these so-called hubs, only four hubs to feed 2 million people, allegedly. And utter chaos broke out as Palestinians overran the location. They were subjected to horrible, degrading conditions. And UN officials have said that 50 people were shot by the Israeli soldiers or the US mercenaries, and several are reported to have died from their injuries. I mean, what is the purpose of all that? Is it just propaganda? Is it part of the plan? Is it, people have said that it's part of the plan to force Palestinians south and then force them out of Gaza? What, if anything, do you know? Of course, you wrote the book about Blackwater, the mercenary army in Iraq. What do you know, if anything, about the U.S. mercenaries who are involved in this? Just any further light you can shed on that aspect?
Yeah, I mean, it, you know, also a friend of mine, Heba Jamal, her four members of her husband's family, they're from Khan Yunis, were murdered by Israel yesterday after they had received aid packages four members of her family were, she's a Palestinian American journalist, and her husband's family is from Khan Yunis. Her family is also from Gaza. And, you know, I heard from Heba this morning that they were murdered by Israeli forces after they had picked up this pittance of aid, you know, these boxes that don't, you know, they won't last for days, you know, and they don't include baby formula. They don't include medicine. It's just, you know, it's basic provisions you get at a bodega, basically. This isn't real. And, you know, but that's how desperate people are. And there was no coordination. You know, so people go and they hear about it word of mouth. It wasn't like there was some clear guidelines given. Text messages, WhatsApp messages, they're going to be distributing aid at this place. So people descend on it. And then there's an attempt to do biometric screening of people. Israel had announced in advance that there was going to be a political vetting to ensure that no one affiliated with Hamas received aid, which is insane if you know anything about Palestinian politics. I mean, how do you determine who is Hamas? The postal worker is Hamas, you know, the garbage collector is Hamas, you know, so they start doing this. And meanwhile, more and more people are descending on the place, and they actually kidnap some people. There was one case that we reported on where a man from a family goes, he is interrogated by Israeli intelligence officers, and they actually get on the phone with his family and they're demanding information about some relative of theirs that none of them had been in touch with since the beginning of the genocide. And when the family was unable to provide them with sufficient answers, they snatched him and he's disappeared, and the family still hasn't heard from them. And they're appealing to the Red Cross and the Red Crescent to compel Israel to reveal his whereabouts. There were more than 10 other people that we understand, and the number may even be larger now, that were just snatched. But the intent of this, and Netanyahu said the quiet part out loud in a recent speech, and so did Bezalel Smotrich for that matter. They said, this is something we have to do because of some of the pressure on us, even from our friends. You know, they don't want the appearance of starvation to be there. But Netanyahu said, this is going to enable us to continue this war. To continue receiving the weapons and not have to deal with any complaints from, you know, from our friends. So I do think that Netanyahu is operating on a couple of tracks. He recognizes maybe that the runway is a bit shorter in the short term because Trump may decide for his own reasons that he wants this to pause. But I think in the overarching picture, we understand that Netanyahu believes that the best move for him is to force all of the Palestinians from the north of Gaza, where most people are, and central Gaza into the south, to put them into a very shrunken killing cage. And from there, they can just continue to mass murder Palestinians. And when it hits the quote unquote end, they can lock that box up where they've come in to get the bait. You know, Israel talks about Palestinians as human animals. Then we'll ship that box off to Libya or Somaliland or somewhere else. I don't think this is just threats meant to bring Hamas to the negotiating table as it's sometimes portrayed. I think this is real. This is Netanyahu's at the zenith of his genocidal career. And he believes that that he has limited time left, but I believe he wants to annihilate the Palestinian people. And I think that this was set up for that. In terms of the mercenaries, some of them actually, Ali, were Blackwater operatives, the guys that are there, and were deployed in war zones working for that company. You know, these are body shops, as they call them in the mercenary industry, where you set it up as a way to maximize profit by using privatized soldiers. And, you know, so these guys are getting paid upwards of $1,000 or $1,200 a day to be on the ground. I think it's around $30,000 a month for the deployment. Many of them are former special operations soldiers. The Gaza Humanitarian Foundation itself has ties to the CIA and Israeli intelligence. It looks very much to me like a cutout, you know, which is a term of espionage, where you set up a front company and maybe it does some quote unquote legitimate business, but it exists to either cover the identities or the actual agenda that you want to implement, you know, or to give the veneer that it's something totally different. And I think that there's a little bit of both of those in here with this. And the name is so cynical, Gaza Humanitarian Foundation. There's nothing humanitarian about it. It's part of the war of annihilation. So they set this thing up. And, you know, I don't know how long they intended it to go for, but the fact that you have U.S. mercenaries, Israeli occupation forces, and on day one, they're already opening fire on Palestinians, kidnapping Palestinians, is a pretty good indication that Netanyahu was telling the truth when he said that this is a necessary component to continue our war to exterminate the Palestinian people from Gaza.
Yeah, I mean, I think last week he said something like, you know, we just have to, like, he said it clearly. We have
he said
to,
it openly, yeah.
Yeah, we have to make it look like we're doing what we need to be doing. It's just, you know, and again, it goes back to this question of, you know, the utility of any sort of meaningful guarantee.
Oh, right.
Utility,
yeah, I forgot to answer that.
Right. No, no, of course. You know, the meaninglessness now of international law, the impotence of the ICJ and the ICC, and no one holding Israel to account, let alone, yeah, you know, any sort of like responsibility for genocide. And now it's become, you know, this like profit making machine with private US mercenaries. I mean, it is as dystopian as it can be.
Well, and also, but we don't know who is funding. You know, it's an opaque organization. I mean, my understanding is there are very likely some Gulf nations that are involved with, you know, with financing this. And I mean, you're raising something really serious, Nora. And, you know, when you speak to Palestinians involved with the negotiation, they're deeply aware of this. You know, how do you enforce a ceasefire with Israel? I mean, there's supposedly a ceasefire in Lebanon. You know, Israel is putting the Israeli flag deeper into into Lebanese territory than they've been in many, many years. They're constantly bombing. They're doing drone strikes. They're killing civilians. They're continuing their scorched earth attacks on Lebanon, even when there's supposedly a ceasefire. This is the whole history of Israel's actions towards Palestinians. They never respect any deal. So if you're in the position of being a Palestinian negotiator and you're dealing with an enemy or an adversary like that, your options are very limited. There are hundreds upon hundreds of UN resolutions that apply to Israel. There are world court rulings from both the criminal side and the International Court of Justice that are just flagrantly violated and ignored. The European Union is totally impotent at worst, and at best it's impotent in the face of this. At worst, it's just an enabler.
Yeah,
it's an enabler of the whole thing. Yes, it's positive that France, Britain, and Canada took the position that they did recently. Yes, it's good that Germany has started, you know, to offer some mild criticism. But let history never forget, and Ali is the master on this when it comes to Germany, but let history never forget that a big part of the story of Palestine is that Palestinians are being mercilessly punished for Germany's crimes against Jews and other minorities in World War II. And so there is no enforcement mechanism, Nora. And that's why, you know, people poke at this. Oh, who would believe Trump? Who would believe Witkoff? If you're a Palestinian negotiator, what is the card in your hand when it comes to enforcement? That's why they wanted Steve Witkoff to publicly shake hands with Khalil al-Haya, the lead negotiator for Hamas. That's why they want Donald Trump to publicly announce the ceasefire. That's why they want Witkoff to be listed as a guarantor of the ceasefire. They know that none of these are a UN resolution, but a UN resolution doesn't work either. So I think that what we're looking at is, you know, you have to sort of put yourself in their position. They're trying to do things that would bring some form of public accountability. And it's a nightmare. It's a total nightmare scenario. And the only currency that they have are 58 Israelis, 20 of whom are believed to be alive, 3 of whom we don't know the status of, and 35 are dead. You guys talk about this all the time, but you know, people say they're holding dead bodies. Read the term sheet. They're saying they're going to give back 198 bodies of Palestinians. That's just a fraction of the Palestinian bodies that are being held by Israel in refrigerators or in numbered graves, some of them for decades. Israel holds dead Palestinians as ransom and has been doing this for a very, very long time. So, you know, I think that we're in a situation where they've decided, Hamas and Islamic Jihad, that the only enforcement mechanism that they can get out of this is public pledges from Donald Trump and signatures on documents and handshakes. I mean, that is the reality.
And there is one other part. So, you know, as you said, their only currency in terms of the negotiations is the 58 Israeli prisoners of war or other captives or bodies that are in Gaza. But that's why fundamentally the resistance cannot give up its weapons in this context, because that is the only other guarantee that Israel won't just come in and murder everyone. You know, like as happened in 1982 in Sabra and Shatila, all Palestinians remember that precedent when the Reagan administration at the time brokered a deal that the PLO, the Palestine Liberation Organization, would, its armed forces would leave Beirut and withdraw from Lebanon, which they did by sea, and they went to Tunis. And the Reagan administration gave a pledge that the Palestinian civilians, the refugees, would be safe. But what happened immediately is that Israeli-backed Lebanese militias, under the protection of Israeli occupation forces, went in and massacred thousands of people immediately. So that's why the not giving up the weapons is really the only other guarantee, and why I think you're right that Palestinians are not going to, the resistance groups are not going to concede on that point.
You know, I mean, I also think, again, I mean, I'm on Electronic Intifada's live stream that I watch, so I know I'm not telling you anything that you don't already know or haven't covered more extensively and better than I have, but I think it always bears repeating. Armed Palestinian resistance groups are national liberation movements. They are armed factions of a national liberation movement. And that doesn't mean you can't debate tactics, but that point needs to be clearly stated as a indisputable fact. And there has been a 70-year-long campaign that has been very effective to put Palestinians in a category of their own, that when Palestinians use force to try to defend themselves or assert their rights, that they are designated as terrorists. That's why U.S. terror laws are rooted in going after people that support Palestine and Palestinians themselves. And you know, the right of armed resistance is a right that all people in the world have to confront occupation, to confront apartheid. So, you know, the starting point for this, with anyone who's serious and knows anything about history, has to be Palestinians have a right to defend themselves against this colonial apartheid occupation regime. Where it gets where it sort of gets problematic when the U.S. and Israel are in the equation, and even some of these Arab Gulf states that are, you know, involved with this or with Egypt, is that they're also adopting that framework to describe Palestinians or to designate their armed resistance as terrorism. If the Palestinians were to agree to any terms of disarmament, it would be the end of the cause of Palestine. It's a fact. So, you know, when people say, well, why doesn't Hamas just lay down its arms? It's not about Hamas laying down its arms. Hamas has said that they don't need to be the governing authority at all in Gaza anymore. Hamas said they want a day when they aren't a resistance movement anymore, when there is a Palestinian state that is respected in the world, that its rights are respected the same way as others. And I think that they feel that they have a national responsibility.
You were listening to Electronic Intifada, an interview with the great Jeremy Scahill, really giving us a sobering assessment of what's really going on with this supposedly ceasefire negotiations that's happening. As you heard, Witkoff has been assigned to do the negotiations, and actually the negotiations were going well until, obviously, as always, Israel had turned down the conditions, and then Witkoff quickly blamed the Palestinian resistance for rejecting it, and obviously it wasn't. But we know that the intention is to always put hurdles in a peace process, because as long as Netanyahu is alive and well, he's going to maintain his power by continuing this genocide, this never-ending genocide. And the latest scam is this, or the latest way for him to buy time, is to pretend that he is supplying aid, and with the help of these shady American organizations and the U.S. government, the shadiest of all governments, is trying to entrap Palestinians in the south and push them even further south or starve them to death and create these killing cages, which are supposed to be safe zones where they can get aid. Of course, to draw them in the southernmost part into that area. And then they have excuses if there's if there seems to be disturbances, as they call them, among the crowd. They just start shooting to the crowd, which is their way of perpetuating a Holocaust of Palestinians, the slow going Holocaust. We'll stay tuned. Please stay tuned to the Gaza flotilla, which is still making its way to Gaza. And stay tuned to this congregation that's going to happen on the Rafah border, or rather gathering, to march on to Gaza. Let's see what happens in the next week. We'll be reporting on that next Wednesday at 2 p.m., as we do every Wednesday. This is Zain al-Amin with the Shayem Nana Show, signing off.
Quite interesting.
For WPFW News in Washington and WBAI in New York, I'm Sue Goodwin. Here are some headlines. A second round of direct peace talks this week between Russia and Ukraine ended after only 1 hour and without a major breakthrough toward a ceasefire and no clear path forward. Meanwhile, a new report reveals the stunning cost of the war on both sides of the conflict. WPFW's Noah Portner reports.
According to a report released yesterday by the Bipartisan Center for Strategic and International Studies, the total battle casualties in Ukraine has reached 1.4 million. Notable is the discrepancy between Russian and Ukrainian casualties, with the Russians suffering nearly 1 million killed or wounded, while Ukraine suffered around half that amount. The CSIS's research also stressed the slow rate of the Russian advance, with the Russians seizing 5,000 square kilometers since January 2024. That's less than 1% of Ukraine's total territory in well over a year. Despite the fact that growing numbers of policymakers and analysts feel the war unwinnable, the CSIS reports, quote, "The evidence suggests that Russia has largely failed to achieve its primary objectives and has suffered high costs," end quote. From WPFW News, I'm Noah Portner.
In other news, the U.S. and Israeli-backed Gaza Humanitarian Foundation put its operations on hold today and will not give out any aid as it presses Israel to boost civilian safety. Also today, Israel's military said that approach roads to the sites will be, quote, considered combat zones, close quote. The temporary suspension of aid comes as more than 100 Palestinian people seeking aid have been reported killed by Israeli gunfire in the vicinity of the foundation's distribution hubs. The killing of people desperately seeking food supplies has triggered mounting international outrage, with United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres demanding an independent inquiry into the deaths. Guterres said, quote, "It is unacceptable that Palestinians are risking their lives for food," close quote. The United Nations and other aid agencies have refused to work with the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation, accusing the group of lacking neutrality and being part of Israel's militarization of aid in Gaza. And as Pride Month begins, Secretary of Defense Hegseth ordered the name of gay author and gay rights pioneer Harvey Milk removed from a newly constructed Navy oil tanker. WPFW's Noah Portner has the story.
Hegseth justified his decision by referencing the president's anti-DEI priorities and saying that ship names should be reflective of a quote-unquote warrior ethos. Ostensibly, Hegseth does not believe a gay man properly embodies this ethos. The ship was part of the John Lewis class of oilers, and all were planned to carry the names of civil rights advocates. Milk served for years in the Navy during the Korean War and was eventually discharged due to his sexuality. Milk went on to write prolifically about gay culture and served as an elected official to San Francisco before his assassination. House Minority Speaker Hakeem Jeffries called the move a complete disgrace and likened it to erasure of black cultural icons.